quite clear that neither intelligence nor tool-making by themselves can account for the sapiens' conquest of the world. According to most definitions of intelligence, 1 million years ago humans were already the most intelligent animals around, as well as the world's champion tool-makers. Yet they remained insignificant creatures with little impact on the surrounding ecosystem. They were obviously lacking some key feature other than intelligence and tool-making. Perhaps humankind eventually came to dominate the planet not because of some elusive third key ingredient, but due simply to the evolution of even higher intelligence and even better tool-making abilities. It doesn't seem so, because when we examine the historical record, we don't see a direct correlation between the intelligence and tool-making abilities of individual humans and the power of our species as a whole. 20,000 years ago, the average sapiens probably had higher intelligence and better tool-making skills than the average sapiens of today. Modern schools and employers may test our aptitudes from time to time, but no matter how badly we do, the welfare state always guarantees our basic needs. In the Stone Age, natural selection tested you every single moment of every single day, and if you flunked any of its numerous tests, you were pushing up the daisies in no time. Yet despite the superior tool-making abilities of our Stone Age ancestors, and despite their sharper minds and far more acute senses, 20,000 years ago, humankind was much weaker than it is today. Over those 20,000 years, humankind moved from hunting mammoth with stone-tipped spears to exploring the solar system with spaceships, not thanks to the evolution of more dexterous hands or bigger brains. Our brains today actually seem to be smaller. Instead, the crucial factor in our conquest of the world was our ability to connect many humans to one another. Humans nowadays completely dominate the planet, not because the individual human is far smarter and more nimble-figured than the individual chimp or wolf, but because Homo sapiens is the only species on Earth capable of cooperating flexibly in large numbers. Intelligence and tool-making were obviously very important as well, but if humans had not learned to cooperate flexibly in large numbers, our crafty brains and deft hands would still be splitting flintstones rather than uranium atoms. If cooperation is the key, how come the ants and bees did not beat us to the nuclear bomb, even though they learned to cooperate en masse millions of years before us? Because their cooperation lacks flexibility. Bees cooperate in very sophisticated ways, but they cannot reinvent their social system overnight. If a hive faces a new threat or a new opportunity, the bees cannot, for example, guillotine the queen and establish a republic. Social mammals such as elephants and chimpanzees cooperate far more flexibly than bees, but they do so only with small numbers of friends and family members. Their cooperation is based on personal acquaintance. If I am a chimpanzee and you are a chimpanzee, and I want to cooperate with you, I must know you personally. What kind of chimp are you? Are you a nice chimp? Are you an evil chimp? How can I cooperate with you if I don't know you? To the best of our knowledge, only sapiens can cooperate in very flexible ways with countless numbers of strangers. This concrete capability, rather than an eternal soul or some unique kind of consciousness, explains our mastery of planet Earth. Long live the revolution. History provides ample evidence for the crucial importance of large-scale cooperation. Victory almost invariably went to those who cooperated better, not only in struggles between Homo sapiens and other animals, but also in conflicts between different human groups. Thus, Rome conquered Greece not because the Romans had larger brains or better tool-making techniques, but because they were able to cooperate more effectively. Throughout history, disciplined armies easily routed disorganized hordes, and unified elites dominated the disorderly masses. In 1914, for example, 3 million Russian noblemen, officials, and business people lorded it over 180 million peasants and workers. The Russian elite knew how to cooperate in defense of its common interests, whereas the 180 million commoners were incapable of effective mobilization. Indeed, much of the elite's efforts focused on ensuring that the 180 million people at the bottom would never learn to cooperate. In order to mount a revolution, numbers are never enough. Revolutions are usually made by small networks of agitators rather than by the masses. If you want to launch a revolution, don't ask yourself, how many people support my ideas? Instead, ask yourself, how many of my supporters are capable of effective collaboration? The Russian Revolution finally erupted not when 180 million peasants rose against the Tsar, but rather when a handful of communists placed themselves at the right place at the right time. In 1917, at a time when the Russian upper and middle classes numbered at least 3 million people, the Communist Party had just 23,000 members. The communists nevertheless gained control of the vast Russian Empire because they organized themselves well. When authority in Russia slipped from the decrepit hands of the Tsar and the equally shaky hands of Kerensky's provisional government, the communists seized it with alacrity, gripping the reins of power like a bulldog locking its jaws on a bone. The communists didn't release their grip until the late 1980s. Effective organization kept them in power for 8 long decades, and they eventually fell due to defective organization. On the 21st of December 1989, Nicolae Ceausescu, the communist dictator of Romania, organized a mass demonstration of support in the center of Bucharest. Over the previous months, the Soviet Union had withdrawn its support from the Eastern European communist regimes, the Berlin Wall had fallen, and revolutions had swept Poland, East Germany, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Czechoslovakia. Ceausescu, who had ruled Romania since 1965, believed he could withstand the tsunami, even though riots against his rule had erupted in the Romanian city of Timișoara on the 17th of December. As one of his countermeasures, Ceausescu arranged a massive rally in Bucharest to prove to Romanians and the rest of the world that the majority of the populace still loved him, or at least feared him. The creaking party apparatus mobilized 80,000 people to fill the city's central square, and citizens throughout Romania were instructed to stop all their activities and tune in on their radios and televisions. To the cheering of the seemingly enthusiastic crowd, Ceausescu mounted the balcony overlooking the square, as he had done scores of times in previous decades. Flanked by his wife, Elena, leading party officials, and a bevy of bodyguards, Ceausescu began delivering one of his trademark dreary speeches. For 8 minutes, he praised the glories of Romanian socialism, looking very pleased with himself as the crowd clapped mechanically. And then something went wrong. You can see it for yourself on YouTube. Just search for Ceausescu's last speech and watch history in action. The YouTube clip shows Ceausescu starting another long sentence saying, "I want to thank the initiators and organizers of this great event in Bucharest, considering it as a..." And then he falls silent, his eyes open wide, and he freezes in disbelief. He never finished the sentence. You can see in that split second how an entire world collapses. Somebody in the audience booed. People still argue today who was the first person who dared to boo. And then another person booed, and another, and another, and within a few seconds, the masses began whistling, shouting abuse, and calling out, "Timișoara! Timișoara!" All this happened live on Romanian television, as 3/4 of the populace sat glued to their screens, their hearts throbbing wildly. The notorious secret police, the Securitate, immediately ordered the broadcast to be stopped, but the television crews disobeyed. The cameraman pointed the camera towards the sky so that viewers couldn't see the panic among the party leaders on the balcony, but the sound man kept recording, and the technicians continued the transmission. The whole of Romania heard the crowd booing while Ceausescu yelled, "Hello, hello, hello," as if the problem was with the microphone. His wife, Elena, began scolding the audience, "Be quiet! Be quiet!" Until Ceausescu turned and yelled at her, still live on television, "You be quiet!" Ceausescu then appealed to the excited crowds in the square, imploring them, "Comrades! Comrades! Be quiet, comrades! But the comrades were unwilling to be quiet. Communist Romania crumbled when 80,000 people in the Bucharest Central Square realized they were much stronger than the old man in the fur hat on the balcony. What is truly astounding, however, is not the moment the system collapsed, but the fact that it managed to survive for decades. Why are revolutions so rare? Why do the masses sometimes clap and cheer for centuries on end, doing everything the man on the balcony commands them, even though they could, in theory, charge forward at any moment and tear him to pieces? Ceausescu and his cronies dominated 20 million Romanians for 4 decades because they ensured 3 vital conditions. First, they placed loyal communist apparatchiks in control of all networks of cooperation, such as the army, trade unions, and even sports associations. Second, they prevented the creation of any rival organizations, whether political, economic, or social, which might serve as a basis for anti-communist cooperation. Third, they relied on the support of sister communist parties in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Despite occasional tensions, these parties helped each other in times of need, or at least guaranteed that no outsider poked his nose into the socialist paradise. Under such conditions, despite all the hardship and suffering inflicted on them by the ruling elite, the 20 million Romanians were unable to organize any effective opposition. Ceausescu fell from power only once all 3 conditions no longer held. In the late 1980s, the Soviet Union withdrew its protection, and the communist regimes began falling like dominoes. By December 1989, Ceausescu could not expect any outside assistance. Just the opposite. Revolutions in nearby countries gave heart to the local opposition. The Communist Party itself began splitting into rival camps. The moderates wished to rid themselves of Ceausescu and initiate reforms before it was too late. By organizing the Bucharest demonstration and broadcasting it live on television, Ceausescu himself provided the revolutionaries with the perfect opportunity to discover their power and rally against him. What quicker way to spread a revolution than by showing it on TV? Yet when power slipped from the hands of the clumsy organizer on the balcony, it did not pass to the masses in the square. Though numerous and enthusiastic, the crowds did not know how to organize themselves. Hence, just as in Russia in 1917, power passed to a small group of political players whose only asset was good organization. The Romanian Revolution was hijacked by the self-proclaimed National Salvation Front, which was in fact a smokescreen for the moderate wing of the Communist Party. The front had no real ties to the demonstrating crowds. It was manned by mid-ranking party officials and led by Ion Iliescu, a former member of the Communist Party's Central Committee and one-time head of the propaganda department. Iliescu and his comrades in the National Salvation Front reinvented themselves as democratic politicians, proclaimed to any available microphone that they were the leaders of the revolution, and then used their long experience and network of cronies to take control of the country and pocket its resources. In communist Romania, almost everything was owned by the state. Democratic Romania quickly privatized its assets, selling them at bargain prices to the ex-communists, who alone grasped what was happening and collaborated to feather each other's nests. Government companies that controlled national infrastructure and natural resources were sold to former communist officials at end-of-season prices, while the party's foot soldiers bought houses and apartments for pennies. Ion Iliescu was elected president of Romania, while his colleagues became ministers, parliament members, bank directors, and multimillionaires. The new Romanian elite that controls the country to this day is composed mostly of former communists and their families. The masses who risked their necks in Timișoara and Bucharest settled for scraps because they did not know how to cooperate and how to create an efficient organization to look after their own interests. A similar fate befell the Egyptian Revolution of 2011. What television did in 1989, Facebook and Twitter did in 2011. The new media helped the masses coordinate their activities, so that thousands of people flooded the streets and squares at the right moment and toppled the Mubarak regime. However, it is one thing to bring 100,000 people to Tahrir Square and quite another to get a grip on the political machinery, shake the right hands in the right back rooms, and run a country effectively. Consequently, when Mubarak stepped down, the demonstrators could not fill the vacuum. Egypt had only two institutions sufficiently organized to rule the country, the army and the Muslim Brotherhood. Hence, the revolution was hijacked first by the Brotherhood and eventually by the army. The Romanian ex-communists and the Egyptian generals were not more intelligent or nimble-fingered than either the old dictators or the demonstrators in Bucharest and Cairo. Their advantage lay in flexible cooperation. They cooperated better than the crowds, and they were willing to show far more flexibility than the hide-bound Ceausescu and Mubarak. Beyond sex and violence. If sapiens rule the world because we alone can cooperate flexibly in large numbers, then this undermines our belief in the sacredness of human beings. We tend to think that we are special and deserve all kinds of privileges. As proof, we point to the amazing achievements of our species. We built the pyramids and the Great Wall of China. We deciphered the structure of atoms and DNA molecules. We reached the South Pole and the Moon. If these accomplishments resulted from some unique essence that each individual has, an immortal soul, say, then it would make sense to sanctify human life. Yet, since these triumphs actually result from mass cooperation, it is far less clear why they should make us revere individual humans. A beehive has much greater power than an individual butterfly, yet that doesn't imply a bee is therefore more hallowed than a butterfly. The Romanian Communist Party successfully dominated the disorganized Romanian population. Does it follow that the life of a party member was more sacred than the life of an ordinary citizen? Humans know how to cooperate far more effectively than chimpanzees, which is why humans launch spaceships to the moon, whereas chimpanzees throw stones at zoo visitors. Does it mean that humans are superior beings? Well, maybe. It depends on what enables humans to cooperate so well in the first place. Why are humans alone able to construct such large and sophisticated social systems? Social cooperation among most social mammals, such as chimpanzees, wolves, and dolphins, relies on intimate acquaintance. Among common chimpanzees, individuals will go hunting together only after they have got to know each other well and established a social hierarchy. Hence, chimpanzees spend a lot of time in social interactions and power struggles. When alien chimpanzees meet, they usually cannot cooperate, but instead scream at each other, fight, or flee as quickly as possible. Among pygmy chimpanzees, also known as bonobos, things are a bit different. Bonobos often use sex in order to dispel tensions and cement social bonds. Not surprisingly, homosexual intercourse is consequently very common among them. When two alien groups of bonobos encounter one another, at first they display fear and hostility, and the jungle is filled with howls and screams. Soon enough, however, females from one group cross No Chimps Land and invite the strangers to make love instead of war. The invitation is usually accepted, and within a few minutes the potential battlefield teems with bonobos having sex in almost every conceivable posture, including hanging upside down from trees. Sapiens know these cooperative tricks well. They sometimes form power hierarchies similar to those of common chimpanzees, whereas on other occasions they cement social bonds with sex just like bonobos. Yet personal acquaintance, whether it involves fighting or copulating, cannot form the basis for large-scale cooperation. You cannot settle the Greek debt crisis by inviting Greek politicians and German bankers to either a fistfight or an orgy. Research indicates that sapiens just can't have intimate relations, whether hostile or amorous, with more than 150 individuals. Whatever enables humans to organize mass cooperation networks, it isn't intimate relations. This is bad news for psychologists, sociologists, economists, and others who try to decipher human society through laboratory experiments. For both organizational and financial reasons, The vast majority of experiments are conducted either on individuals or on small groups of participants. Yet it is risky to extrapolate from small group behavior to the dynamics of mass societies. A nation of 100 million people functions in a fundamentally different way to a band of 100 individuals. Take, for example, the ultimatum game, one of the most famous experiments in behavioral economics. This experiment is usually conducted on two people. One of them gets $100, which he must divide between himself and the other participant in any way he wants. He may keep everything, split the money in half, or give most of it away. The other player can do one of two things: accept the suggested division, or reject it outright. If he rejects the division, nobody gets anything. Classical economic theories maintain that humans are rational calculating machines. They propose that most people will keep $99 and offer $1 to the other participant. They further propose that the other participant will accept the offer. A rational person offered a dollar will always say yes. What does he care if the other player gets $99? Classical economists have probably never left their laboratories and lecture halls to venture into the real world. Most people playing the ultimatum game reject very low offers because they are unfair. They prefer losing a dollar to looking like suckers. Since this is how the real world functions, few people make very low offers in the first place. Most people divide the money equally, or give themselves only a moderate advantage, offering $30 or $40 to the other player. The ultimatum game made a significant contribution to undermining classical economic theories and to establishing the most important economic discovery of the last few decades. Sapiens don't behave according to a cold mathematical logic, but rather according to a warm social logic. We are ruled by emotions. These emotions, as we saw earlier, are in fact sophisticated algorithms that reflect the social mechanisms of ancient hunter-gatherer bands. If 30,000 years ago I helped you hunt a wild chicken and you then kept almost all the chicken to yourself, offering me just one wing, I did not say to myself, "Better one wing than nothing at all." Instead, my evolutionary algorithms kicked in. Adrenaline and testosterone flooded my system, my blood boiled, and I stamped my feet and shouted at the top of my voice. In the short term, I may have gone hungry, and even risked a punch or two. But it paid off in the long term, because you thought twice before ripping me off again. We refuse unfair offers because people who meekly accepted unfair offers didn't survive in the Stone Age. Observations of contemporary hunter-gatherer bands support this idea. Most bands are highly egalitarian, and when a hunter comes back to camp carrying a fat deer, everybody gets a share. The same is true of chimpanzees. When one chimp kills a piglet, the other troop members will gather round him with outstretched hands, and usually they all get a piece. In another recent experiment, the primatologist Franz de Waal placed two capuchin monkeys in two adjacent cages, so that each could see everything the other was doing. De Waal and his colleagues placed small stones inside each cage and trained the monkeys to give them these stones. Whenever a monkey handed over a stone, he received food in exchange. At first, the reward was a piece of cucumber. Both monkeys were very pleased with that and happily ate their cucumber. After a few rounds, de Waal moved to the next stage of the experiment. This time, when the first monkey surrendered a stone, he got a grape. Grapes are much more tasty than cucumbers. However, when the second monkey gave a stone, he still received a piece of cucumber. The second monkey, who was previously very happy with his cucumber, became incensed. He took the cucumber, looked at it in disbelief for a moment, and then threw it at the scientist in anger, and began jumping and screeching loudly. He ain't a sucker. This hilarious experiment, which you can see for yourself on YouTube, along with the ultimatum game, has led many to believe that primates have a natural morality, and that equality is a universal and timeless value. People are egalitarian by nature, and unequal societies can never function well due to resentment and dissatisfaction. But is that really so? These theories may work well on chimpanzees, capuchin monkeys, and small hunter-gatherer bands. They also work well in the lab, where you test them on small groups of people. Yet, once you observe the behavior of human masses, you discover a completely different reality. Most human kingdoms and empires were extremely unequal, yet many of them were surprisingly stable and efficient. In ancient Egypt, the pharaoh sprawled on comfortable cushions inside a cool and sumptuous palace, wearing golden sandals and gem-studded tunics, while beautiful maids popped sweet grapes into his mouth. Through the open window, he could see the peasants in the fields, toiling in dirty rags under a merciless sun, and blessed was the peasant who had a cucumber to eat at the end of the day. Yet the peasants rarely revolted. In 1740, King Frederick II of Prussia invaded Silesia, thus commencing a series of bloody wars that earned him his sobriquet Frederick the Great, turned Prussia into a major power, and left hundreds of thousands of people dead, crippled, or destitute. Most of Frederick's soldiers were hapless recruits, subject to iron discipline and draconian drill. Not surprisingly, the soldiers lost little love on their supreme commander. As Frederick watched his troops assemble for the invasion, he told one of his generals that what struck him most about the scene was that, "We are standing here in perfect safety, looking at 60,000 men. They are all our enemies, and there is not one of them who is not better armed and stronger than we are, and yet they all tremble in our presence, while we have no reason whatsoever to be afraid of them." Frederick could indeed watch them in perfect safety. During the following years, despite all the hardships of war, these 60,000 armed men never revolted against him. Indeed, many of them served him with exceptional courage, risking and even sacrificing their very lives. Why did the Egyptian peasants and Prussian soldiers act so differently than we would have expected on the basis of the ultimatum game and the capuchin monkeys experiment? Because large numbers of people behave in a fundamentally different way than do small numbers. What would scientists see if they conducted the ultimatum game experiment on two groups of 1 million people each, who had to share $100 billion? They would probably have witnessed strange and fascinating dynamics. For example, since 1 million people cannot make decisions collectively, each group might sprout a small ruling elite. What if one elite offers the other $10 billion, keeping $90 billion? The leaders of the second group might well accept this unfair offer, siphon most of the $10 billion into their Swiss bank accounts, while preventing rebellion among their followers with a combination of sticks and carrots. The leadership might threaten to severely punish dissidents forthwith, while promising the meek and patient everlasting rewards in the afterlife. This is what happened in ancient Egypt and 18th century Prussia, and this is how things still work out in numerous countries around the world. Such threats and promises often succeed in creating stable human hierarchies and mass cooperation networks, as long as people believe that they reflect the inevitable laws of nature, or the divine commands of God, rather than just human whims. All large-scale human cooperation is ultimately based on our belief in imagined orders. These are sets of rules that, despite existing only in our imagination, we believe to be as real and inviolable as gravity. If you sacrifice 10 bulls to the sky god, the rain will come. If you honor your parents, you will go to heaven. And if you don't believe what I am telling you, you'll go to hell. As long as all sapiens living in a particular locality believe in the same stories, they all follow the same rules, making it easy to predict the behavior of strangers and to organize mass cooperation networks. Sapiens often use visual marks, such as a turban, a beard, or a business suit, to signal, "You can trust me, I believe in the same story as you." Our chimpanzee cousins cannot invent and spread such stories, which is why they cannot cooperate in large numbers. The web of meaning. People find it difficult to understand the idea of imagined orders, because they assume that there are only two types of realities, objective realities and subjective realities. In objective reality, things exist independently of our beliefs and feelings. Gravity, for example, is an objective reality. It existed long before Newton, and it affects people who don't believe in it just as much as it affects those who do. Subjective reality, in contrast, depends on my personal beliefs and feelings. Thus, suppose I feel a sharp pain in my head and go to the doctor. The doctor checks me thoroughly, but finds nothing wrong. So she sends me for a blood test, urine test, DNA test, X-ray, electrocardiogram, fMRI scan, and a plethora of other procedures. When the results come in, she announces that I am perfectly healthy and I can go home. Yet I still feel a sharp pain in my head. Even though every objective test has found nothing wrong with me, and even though nobody except me feels the pain, for me, the pain is 100% real. Most people presume that reality is either objective or subjective, and that there is no third option. Hence, once they satisfy themselves that something isn't just their own subjective feeling, they jump to the conclusion it must be objective. If lots of people believe in God, if money makes the world go round, and if nationalism starts wars and builds empires, then these things aren't just a subjective belief of mine. God, money, and nations must therefore be objective realities. However, there is a third level of reality, the intersubjective level. Intersubjective entities depend on communication among many humans, rather than on the beliefs and feelings of individual humans. Many of the most important agents in history are intersubjective. Money, for example, has no objective value. You cannot eat, drink, or wear a dollar bill. Yet as long as billions of people believe in its value, you can use it to buy food, beverages, and clothing. If the baker suddenly loses his faith in the dollar bill and refuses to give me a loaf of bread for this green piece of paper, it doesn't matter much. I can just go down a few blocks to the nearby supermarket. However, if the supermarket cashiers also refuse to accept this piece of paper, along with the hawkers in the market and the salespeople in the mall, then the dollar will lose its value. The green pieces of paper will go on existing, of course, but they will be worthless. Such things actually happen from time to time. On the 3rd of November 1985, the Myanmar government unexpectedly announced that banknotes of 25, 50, and 100 kyats were no longer legal tender. People were given no opportunity to exchange the notes, and savings of a lifetime were instantly turned into heaps of worthless paper. To replace the defunct notes, the government introduced new 75 kyat bills, allegedly in honor of the 75th birthday of Myanmar's dictator, General Ne Win. In August 1986, banknotes of 15 kyats and 35 kyats were issued. Rumor had it that the dictator, who had a strong faith in numerology, believed that 15 and 35 are lucky numbers. They brought little luck to his subjects. On the 5th of September 1987, the government suddenly decreed that all 35 and 75 notes were no longer money. The value of money is not the only thing that might evaporate once people stop believing in it. The same can happen to laws, gods, and even entire empires. One moment they are busy shaping the world, and the next moment they no longer exist. Zeus and Hera were once important powers in the Mediterranean basin, but today they lack any authority because nobody believes in them. The Soviet Union could once destroy the entire human race, yet it ceased to exist at the stroke of a pen. At 2 p.m. on the 8th of December 1991, in a state dacha near Viskuli, the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus signed the Belavezha Accords, which stated that we, the Republic of Belarus, the Russian Federation, and Ukraine, as founding states of the USSR that signed the Union Treaty of 1922, hereby establish that the USSR as a subject of international law and a geopolitical reality ceases its existence. And that was that. No more Soviet Union. It is relatively easy to accept that money is an intersubjective reality. Most people are also happy to acknowledge that ancient Greek gods, evil empires, and the values of alien cultures exist only in the imagination. Yet we don't want to accept that our God, our nation, or our values are mere fictions, because these are the things that give meaning to our lives. We want to believe that our lives have some objective meaning, and that our sacrifices matter to something beyond the stories in our head. Yet in truth, the lives of most people have meaning only within the network of stories they tell one another. Meaning is created when many people weave together a common network of stories. Why does a particular action, such as getting married in church, fasting on Ramadan, or voting on election day, seem meaningful to me? Because my parents also think it is meaningful, as do my brothers, my neighbors, people in nearby cities, and even the residents of far-off countries. And why do all these people think it is meaningful? Because their friends and neighbors also share the same view. People constantly reinforce each other's beliefs in a self-perpetuating loop. Each round of mutual confirmation tightens the web of meaning further, until you have little choice but to believe what everyone else believes. Yet over decades and centuries, the web of meaning unravels, and a new web is spun in its place. To study history means to watch the spinning and unraveling of these webs, and to realize that what seems to people in one age the most important thing in life becomes utterly meaningless to their descendants. In 1187, Saladin defeated the Crusader army at the Battle of Hattin and conquered Jerusalem. In response, the Pope launched the Third Crusade to recapture the Holy City. Imagine a young English nobleman named John, who left home to fight Saladin. John believed that his actions had an objective meaning. He believed that if he died on the crusade, after death his soul would ascend to heaven, where it would enjoy everlasting celestial joy. He would have been horrified to learn that the soul and heaven are just stories invented by humans. John wholeheartedly believed that if he reached the Holy Land, and if some Muslim warrior with a big moustache brought an axe down on his head, he would feel an unbearable pain, his ears would ring, his legs would crumble under him, his field of vision would turn black, and the very next moment he would see brilliant light all around him. He would hear angelic voices and melodious harps, and radiant winged cherubs would beckon him through a magnificent golden gate. John had a very strong faith in all this, because he was enmeshed within an extremely dense and powerful web of meaning. His earlier memories were of Grandpa Henry's rusty sword hanging in the castle's main hall. Ever since he was a toddler, John had heard stories of Grandpa Henry, who died on the Second Crusade, and who is now resting with the angels in heaven, watching over John and his family. When minstrels visited the castle, they usually sang about the brave crusaders who fought in the Holy Land. When John went to church, he enjoyed looking at the stained glass windows. One showed Godfrey of Bouillon riding a horse and impaling a wicked-looking Muslim on his lance. Another showed the souls of sinners burning in hell. John listened attentively to the local priest, the most learned man he knew. Almost every Sunday, the priest explained, with the help of well-crafted parables and hilarious jokes, that there was no salvation outside the Catholic Church, that the Pope in Rome was our Holy Father, and that we always had to obey his commands. If we murdered or stole, God would send us to hell. But if we killed infidel Muslims, God would welcome us to heaven. One day when John was just turning 18, a disheveled knight rode to the castle's gate and in a choked voice announced the news. Saladin has destroyed the Crusader army at Hattin. Jerusalem has fallen. The Pope has declared a new crusade, promising eternal salvation to anyone who dies on it. All around, people look shocked and worried, but John's face lit up in an otherworldly glow, and he proclaimed, "I am going to fight the infidels and liberate the Holy Land." Everyone fell silent for a moment, and then smiles and tears appeared on their faces. His mother wiped her eyes, gave John a big hug, and told him how proud she was of him. His father gave him a mighty pat on the back and said, "If only I was your age, son, I would join you. Our family's honor is at stake. I am sure you won't disappoint us." Two of his friends announced that they were coming too. Even John's sworn rival, the Baron on the other side of the river, paid a visit to wish him Godspeed. As he left the castle, villagers came forth from their hovels to wave to him, and all the pretty girls looked longingly at the brave crusader setting off to fight the infidels. When he set sail from England and made his way through strange and distant lands, Normandy, Provence, Sicily, he was joined by bands of foreign knights, all with the same destination and the same faith. When the army finally disembarked in the Holy Land and waged battle with Saladin's hosts, John was amazed to discover that even the wicked Saracens shared his beliefs. True, they were a bit confused, thinking that the Christians were the infidels and that the Muslims were obeying God's will. Yet they too accepted the basic principle that those fighting for God and Jerusalem will go straight to heaven when they die. In such a way, thread by thread, medieval civilization spun its web of meaning, trapping John and his contemporaries like flies. It was inconceivable to John that all these stories were just figments of the imagination. Maybe his parents and uncles were wrong. But the minstrels too, and all his friends, and the village girls, the learned priest, the baron on the other side of the river, the pope in Rome, the Provençal and Sicilian knights, and even the very Muslims, is it possible that they were all hallucinating? And the years pass. As the historian watches, the web of meaning unravels and another is spun in its stead. John's parents die, followed by all his siblings and friends. Instead of minstrels singing about the Crusades, the new fashion is stage plays about tragic love affairs. The family castle burns to the ground, and when it is rebuilt, no trace is found of Grandpa Henry's sword. The church windows shatter in a winter storm, and the replacement glass no longer depicts Godfrey of Bouillon and the sinners in hell, but rather the great triumph of the King of England over the King of France. The local priest has stopped calling the Pope our Holy Father. He is now referred to as that devil in Rome. In the nearby university, scholars pore over ancient Greek manuscripts, dissect dead bodies, and whisper quietly behind closed doors that perhaps there is no such thing as the soul. And the years continue to pass. Where the castle once stood, there is now a shopping mall. In the local cinema, they are screening Monty Python and the Holy Grail for the umpteenth time. In an empty church, a bored vicar is overjoyed to see two Japanese tourists. He explains at length about the stained glass windows, while they politely smile, nodding in complete incomprehension. On the steps outside, a gaggle of teenagers are playing with their iPhones. They watch a new YouTube remix of John Lennon's Imagine. "Imagine there's no heaven," sings Lennon. "It's easy if you try." A Pakistani street cleaner is sweeping the pavement, while a nearby radio broadcasts the news. The carnage in Syria continues, and the Security Council's meeting has ended in an impasse. Suddenly a hole in time opens. A mysterious ray of light illuminates the face of one of the teenagers, who announces, "I am going to fight the infidels and liberate the Holy Land." Infidels and Holy Land? These words no longer carry any meaning for most people in today's England. Even the vicar would probably think the teenager is having some sort of psychotic episode. In contrast, if an English youth decided to join Amnesty International and travel to Syria to protect the human rights of refugees, he will be seen as a hero. In the Middle Ages, people would have thought he had gone bonkers. Nobody in 12th century England knew what human rights were. You want to travel to the Middle East and risk your life, not in order to kill Muslims, but to protect one group of Muslims from another? You must be out of your mind. That's how history unfolds. People weave a web of meaning, believe in it with all their heart. But sooner or later the web unravels, and when we look back, we cannot understand how anybody could have taken it seriously. With hindsight, going on crusade in the hope of reaching paradise sounds like utter madness. With hindsight, the Cold War seems even madder. How come 30 years ago people were willing to risk nuclear holocaust because of their belief in a communist paradise? 100 years hence, Our belief in democracy and human rights might look equally incomprehensible to our descendants. Dreamtime. Sapiens rule the world because only they can weave an intersubjective web of meaning. A web of laws, forces, entities, and places that exist purely in their common imagination. This web allows humans alone to organize crusades, socialist revolutions, and human rights movements. Other animals may also imagine various things. A cat waiting to ambush a mouse might not see the mouse, but may well imagine the shape and even taste of the mouse. Yet, to the best of our knowledge, cats are able to imagine only things that actually exist in the world, like mice. They cannot imagine things that they have never seen or smelled or tasted, such as the US dollar, Google Corporation, or the European Union. Only sapiens can imagine such chimeras. Consequently, whereas cats and other animals are confined to the objective realm and use their communication systems merely to describe reality, sapiens use language to create completely new realities. During the last 70,000 years, the intersubjective realities that sapiens invented became ever more powerful, so that today they dominate the world. Will the chimpanzees, the elephants, the Amazon rainforests, and the Arctic glaciers survive the 21st century? This depends on the wishes and decisions of intersubjective entities such as the European Union and the World Bank, entities that exist only in our shared imagination. No other animal can stand up to us, not because they lack a soul or a mind, but because they lack the necessary imagination. Lions can run, jump, claw, and bite, yet they cannot open a bank account or file a lawsuit. And in the 21st century, a banker who knows how to file a lawsuit is far more powerful than the most ferocious lion in the savannah. As well as separating humans from other animals, this ability to create intersubjective entities also separates the humanities from the life sciences. Historians seek to understand the development of intersubjective entities like gods and nations, whereas biologists hardly recognize the existence of such things. Some believe that if we could only crack the genetic code and map every neuron in the brain, we will know all of humanity's secrets. After all, if humans have no soul, and if thoughts, emotions, and sensations are just biochemical algorithms, why can't biology account for all the vagaries of human societies? From this perspective, the Crusades were territorial disputes shaped by evolutionary pressures, and English knights going to fight Saladin in the Holy Land were not that different from wolves trying to appropriate the territory of a neighboring pack. The humanities, in contrast, emphasize the crucial importance of intersubjective entities, which cannot be reduced to hormones and neurons. To think historically means to ascribe real power to the contents of our imaginary stories. Of course, historians don't ignore objective factors, such as climate changes and genetic mutations, but they give much greater importance to the stories people invent and believe. North Korea and South Korea are so different from one another, not because people in Pyongyang have different genes to people in Seoul, or because the North is colder and more mountainous. It's because the North is dominated by very different fictions. Maybe someday breakthroughs in neurobiology will enable us to explain communism and the Crusades in strictly biochemical terms. Yet we are very far from that point. During the 21st century, the border between history and biology is likely to blur, not because we will discover biological explanations for historical events, but rather because ideological fictions will rewrite DNA strands, political and economic interests will redesign the climate, and the geography of mountains and rivers will give way to cyberspace. As human fictions are translated into genetic and electronic codes, the intersubjective reality will swallow up the objective reality, and biology will merge with history. In the 21st century, fiction might thereby become the most potent force on Earth, surpassing even wayward asteroids and natural selection. Hence, if we want to understand our future, cracking genomes and crunching numbers is hardly enough. We must also decipher the fictions that give meaning to the world. Part 2. Homo sapiens gives meaning to the world. What kind of world did humans create? How did humans become convinced that they not only control the world, but also give it meaning? How did humanism, the worship of humankind, become the most important religion of all? 4. The Storytellers. Animals such as wolves and chimpanzees live in a dual reality. On the one hand, they are familiar with objective entities outside them, such as trees, rocks, and rivers. On the other hand, they are aware of subjective experiences within them, such as fear, joy, and desire. Sapiens, in contrast, live in triple-layered reality. In addition to trees, rivers, fears, and desires, the sapiens world also contains stories about money, gods, nations, and corporations. As history unfolded, the impact of gods, nations, and corporations grew at the expense of rivers, fears, and desires. There are still many rivers in the world, and people are still motivated by their fears and wishes, but Jesus Christ, the French Republic, and Apple Inc. have dammed and harnessed the rivers, and have learned to shape our deepest anxieties and yearnings. Since new 21st century technologies are likely to make such fictions only more potent, understanding our future requires understanding how stories about Christ, France, and Apple have gained so much power. Humans think they make history, but history actually revolves around the web of stories. The basic abilities of individual humans have not changed much since the Stone Age. But the web of stories has grown from strength to strength, thereby pushing history from the Stone Age to the Silicon Age. It all began about 70,000 years ago, when the cognitive revolution enabled sapiens to start talking about things that existed only in their own imagination. For the following 60,000 years, sapiens wove many fictional webs, but these remained small and local. The spirit of a revered ancestor worshipped by one tribe was completely unknown to its neighbors, and seashells valuable in one locality became worthless once you crossed the nearby mountain range. Stories about ancestral spirits and precious seashells still gave sapiens a huge advantage, because they allowed hundreds and sometimes even thousands of sapiens to cooperate effectively, which was far more than Neanderthals or chimpanzees could do. Yet, as long as sapiens remained hunter-gatherers, they could not cooperate on a truly massive scale, because it was impossible to feed a city or a kingdom by hunting and gathering. Consequently, the spirits, fairies, and demons of the Stone Age were relatively weak entities. The agricultural revolution, which began about 12,000 years ago, provided the necessary material base for enlarging and strengthening the intersubjective networks. Farming made it possible to feed thousands of people in crowded cities and thousands of soldiers in disciplined armies. However, the intersubjective webs then encountered a new obstacle. In order to preserve the collective myths and organize mass cooperation, the early farmers relied on the data processing abilities of the human brain, which were strictly limited. Farmers believed in stories about great gods. They built temples to their favorite god, held festivals in his honor, offered him sacrifices, and gave him lands, tithes, and presents. In the first cities of ancient Sumer, about 6,000 years ago, the temples were not just centers of worship, but also the most important political and economic hubs. The Sumerian gods fulfilled a function analogous to modern brands and corporations. Today, corporations are fictional legal entities that own property, lend money, hire employees, and initiate economic enterprises. In ancient Uruk, Lagash, and Shurupak, the gods functioned as legal entities that could own fields and slaves, give and receive loans, pay salaries, and build dams and canals. Since the gods never died, and since they had no children to fight over their inheritance, they gathered more and more property and power. An increasing number of Sumerians found themselves employed by the gods, taking loans from the gods, tilling the gods' lands, and owing taxes and tithes to the gods. Just as in present-day San Francisco, John is employed by Google while Mary works for Microsoft, so in ancient Uruk, one person was employed by the great god Enki, while his neighbor worked for the goddess Inanna. The temples of Enki and Inanna dominated the Uruk skyline, and their divine logos branded buildings, products, and clothes. For the Sumerians, Enki and Inanna were as real as Google and Microsoft are real for us. Compared to their predecessors, the ghosts and spirits of the Stone Age, the Sumerian gods were very powerful entities. It goes without saying that the gods didn't actually run their businesses, for the simple reason that they didn't exist anywhere except in the human imagination. Day-to-day activities were managed by the temple priests, just as Google and Microsoft need to hire flesh-and-blood humans to manage their affairs. However, as the gods acquired more and more property and power, the priests could not cope. They may have represented the mighty sky god or the all-knowing earth goddess, but they themselves were fallible mortals. They had difficulty remembering all the lands belonging to the goddess Inanna, which of Inanna's employees had received their salary already, which of the goddess's tenants had failed to pay rent, and what interest rate the goddess charged her debtors. This was one of the main reasons why in Sumer, like everywhere else around the world, human cooperation networks could not grow much even thousands of years after the agricultural revolution. There were no huge kingdoms, no extensive trade networks, and no universal religions. This obstacle was finally removed about 5,000 years ago when the Sumerians invented both writing and money. These Siamese twins, born to the same parents at the same time and in the same place, broke the data processing limitations of the human brain. Writing and money made it possible to start collecting taxes from hundreds of thousands of people, to organize complex bureaucracies, and to establish vast kingdoms. In Sumer, these kingdoms were managed in the name of the gods by human priest kings. In the neighboring Nile Valley, people went a step further, merging the priest king with the god to create a living deity, Pharaoh. The Egyptians considered Pharaoh to be an actual god rather than just a divine deputy. The whole of Egypt belonged to that god, and all people had to obey his orders and pay his taxes. Just as in the Sumerian temples, so also in Pharaonic Egypt, the god didn't manage his business empire by himself. Some pharaohs ruled with an iron fist, while others passed their days at banquets and festivities, but in both cases, the practical work of administering Egypt was left to thousands of literate officials. Just like any other human, Pharaoh had a biological body with biological needs, desires, and emotions. But the biological Pharaoh was of little importance. The real ruler of the Nile Valley was an imagined Pharaoh that existed in the stories millions of Egyptians told one another. While Pharaoh sat in his palace in the capital city of Memphis, eating grapes and dallying with his wives and mistresses, Pharaoh's officials crisscrossed the kingdom from the Mediterranean shore to the Nubian desert. The bureaucrats calculated the taxes each village had to pay, wrote them on long papyrus scrolls, and sent them to Memphis. When a written order came from Memphis to recruit soldiers to the army or laborers for some construction project, the officials gathered the necessary men. They computed how many kilograms of wheat the royal granaries contained, how many workdays were required to clean the canals and reservoirs, and how many ducks and pigs to send to Memphis so that Pharaoh's harem could dine well. Even when the living deity died, and his body was embalmed and borne in an extravagant funerary procession to the royal necropolis outside Memphis, the bureaucracy kept going. The officials kept writing scrolls, collecting taxes, sending orders, and oiling the gears of the pharaonic machine. If the Sumerian gods remind us of present-day company brands, so the living god Pharaoh can be compared to modern personal brands such as Elvis Presley, Madonna, or Justin Bieber. Just like Pharaoh, Elvis too had a biological body, complete with biological needs, desires, and emotions. Elvis ate and drank and slept. Yet Elvis was much more than a biological body. Like Pharaoh, Elvis was a story, a myth, a brand, and the brand was far more important than the biological body. During Elvis's lifetime, the brand earned millions of dollars selling records, tickets, posters, and rights, but only a small fraction of the necessary work was done by Elvis in person. Instead, most of it was done by a small army of agents, lawyers, producers, and secretaries.